Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the inaugural Highlights of Structural Entomology. And by the way, Phil has informed me he's looking for a volunteer for next year, because Dan's not doing this next year. So really, if anybody would like to do this, it's a great exercise in getting yourself up to speed on the literature, and you get caught up fairly quickly. So with that, let's get started. Phil had asked me to put together a bibliography for this, and I didn't know where to stop. So at the end of this, probably by the end of this week, Phil will have a bibliography of everything that came up on the search. It's got 620 references in the bibliography. So what we did was we searched, put out a couple emails back in July and October through the National Conference on Urban Entomology's website that came from Roger Gold. Some of you got that call for highlights, and I do thank you. But thanks to the folks who sent slides to me and sent data slides, and you're going to see those here in a few minutes, and slides and references and bibliographies that they had published over the past year as well. So what we ended up doing is certainly any good review of the literature or highlights of structural entomology had to include ants. If you got ants, you got to do termites and cockroaches and certainly bed bugs. I did review the literature on fleas. There's 70 references in the bibliography, but due to time constraints, I'm not going to say anything about fleas. So what we did was we went through the literature's electronic database search. We went through we started back in January of 2007 is where the literature searching started. We looked at CAB, Biosis, and Agricola. None of the references in this bibliography include proceedings from the 2008 ICUP or NCUE meeting. So if you download this bibliography, just keep that in mind that none of those references are included in those proceedings are not in there. The keyword searches, we did the search, it was very broad. So for the termites, for instance, we would search, our search terms were things like reticulotermes or coptotermes or heterotermes for the subs. And then I physically went through and printed those and then highlighted the ones that I thought we should include in the bibliography. We did a visual search of JE and sociobiology just to make sure we weren't missing anything. It is a fairly applied bibliography, but not exclusively. It things that were heavy on the physiology side or neurobiology side, I did not include because this is again, we're a fairly applied group. Okay, let's get into some of the cockroach work. The search terms that we use here were Blattella or Paraplanita, so it covered things like smoky brown roaches and, of course, Asian and German cockroaches. We added 115 references to the bibliography, and it's amazing how things change. If we had done this 10 years ago or 15 years ago, there wouldn't be a whole lot on allergens, and I would venture to say that a third to half of the global literature that's being published now on cockroaches is a lot on allergens. Some of the highlights, Bill Bell, I'm going to cover both books and reviews and some of the highlights, and we'll actually go into and discuss some of the primary peer-reviewed literature. The bibliography has probably 10 or 12 reviews and books in it, but 99% of it is primary peer-reviewed literature. So the first book was a book by Bill Bell, Lou Roth, and Christine Nalepa, three icons, of course, in the cockroach world. Published this book last year on cockroaches. And if you want to know anything about the ecology, biology, and behavior of cockroaches as a tropical group of insects, I would recommend that you get this. I haven't seen it in the exhibit hall, but it may be hidden down there someplace. It's a great book on just general cockroach biology and ecology. So it's a great introduction, lots of references, and I would recommend that. Jeszek Bukowski, Clay Shear, and Gary Bennett at Purdue University published a paper this year in the Journal of Economic Entomology where they were looking at the movement of endoxicarb. It's a pro-insecticide. It has to be activated once it's taken in by the cockroach. There are enzymes that activate the molecule into a metabolite that's active. And what Jeszek wanted to do was look at tertiary control or movement of endoxicarb through the system to a second trophic level after the primary consumer of being the cockroach. So in the past, several years ago, there have been, of course, papers that have been published on the use of hydromethylon in the movement of that active ingredient through at least to the secondary kill. And so first instars will consume the frass of adults in the population, and you wind up with secondary kill. But to my knowledge, there had never been a documented case of tertiary kill. So what Jeshik did was he wanted to document to see whether he could get tertiary kill in a population of cockroaches that had fed on a Advion bait. So what he did was he essentially took a single male adult cockroach here. It may be hard to see in the back, but he let that cockroach feed until it was showing symptoms of intoxication, endoxicarb intoxication. He put that cockroach into a group of that symptomatic cockroach into a group of adult males, and 3 days later, three quarters of them were dead. Okay, so that's secondary kill. He then took those symptomatic first instars, put them in with a group of adult males, and 3 days later, 80% of them were dead. So the consumption of Advion or endoxicarb by a single adult male killed cockroaches two trophic levels later. He wanted to look at, this is another one of those things you probably shouldn't look at right after lunch, but Jeshik was looking at the mechanisms of how this metabolite is transferred from cockroach to cockroach, and symptomatic cockroaches will regurgitate a liquid material, and the first instars were getting in there and feeding on that regurgitate. The second way was they would actually get in, and cockroaches are very necrophagous, and they'll eat the dead bodies of other cockroaches. So he has a very detailed description of how this happens. They cut off the head, they get into the head, and they get into the thorax, and he surmises that there's perhaps metabolite in there, and they're actually getting some of the active metabolite that way, as well as from the emetophagy. And then, of course, coprophagy, where they die in cockroaches or exude this white material. It's probably uric acid, and the cockroaches will consume that. So they're getting this active metabolite in a number of ways. So that was a paper published this year. I said that a lot of the work that had been done on cockroaches in the past several years was on allergens. Kobe Shaw published a paper this year, Kobe Shaw and Chad Gore, on cockroach allergen biology and mitigation in the indoor environment. That was actually last year. So if you want to get into the allergen literature and mitigation of allergens in the indoor environment, that's a real good review there. The paper here by Seaver et al., which was published last year, was titled Cockroach Allergen Reduction by Cockroach Control Alone in Low-Income Urban Homes. A randomized trial was published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. It was really a run-up from several papers that had been published prior to this. And so what they had shown back in Arbus and et al. In the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology and back in 03 and 04 was that, contrary to everything that had been published up to this point, particular allergen, BLA-G1, levels could be reduced below clinical trials with cockroach control alone. So the NCSU group had gone into these apartments where they had high cockroach populations. This was work, again, that was done back in 03 and 04, and demonstrated that by just reducing the cockroach populations, you could reduce the levels of a very key allergen responsible for the development of resistance in occupants. And this was contrary to previous studies that cockroach control alone can significantly reduce these allergens. So there was a letter to the editor of the journal that said, that's fine, you guys can do it. Well, we need an effectiveness trial. So the study that I wanted to talk about here was another paper that was published in 2007. Kobe reported on this last year, a couple years ago, I guess, at NCUE, where what they wanted to do was demonstrate that if you hired a series of pest control companies that would come in, would they be able to reduce the cockroach populations to levels that would end up with reductions in the allergen levels? And the answer to that was no. So what this is a graph that of the number of cockroaches caught per apartment at 6 and 12 months. So the NCSU group went in, and their standard operating procedure was to go in with gel baits. They used gel baits exclusively and went in and used a lot of sticky traps, up to 18 sticky traps in these apartments, and they went back and they were there on a regular basis, had gone in and whatever they had populations that had popped up, they would go in and bait those cockroaches. This was a blind study, so the pest control companies that were hired to do this did not know that they were part of the study. And so the local housing authority actually hired these local pest control companies to do that, to service these apartments for German cockroach control. And you can see here that at 6 months, they had reduced cockroach populations by about 50% compared to about 97% in the NCSU group. The pest control companies were mainly going in and spraying. They were not doing follow-up monitoring as compared to the NCSU group, which was going in and they were putting in sticky traps. So although the population of cockroaches was significantly reduced after 6 months here and 12 months here, the allergen load was not significantly reduced, and it was not significant from the control at either 6 or 12 months. So there are various reasons for this, of course, and certainly one that's right at the top is cost considerations. Pest control companies just don't get paid a lot to go into public housing and control cockroaches. So there's that consideration. There are other considerations, technical and operational considerations. Going back up here, they just can't spend a lot of time in there is the bottom line. So the monitoring and follow-ups, I think, were major differences. The NCSU group was going in and monitoring at a greater level with sticky traps. They were following up, whereas the local companies were not following up. The tactics with bait, they were baiting, the pest control companies were spraying, and they were just in general spending more time in these apartments. So this is a very significant finding in that cockroach control alone can reduce the levels of a key allergen in apartments. I think this is an earth-shattering finding, I think. So let's switch to bed bugs a little bit and talk a little bit about this evolving area of bed bugs. Been for the past 7 to 10 years, I guess. There are 38 references that we added to the bibliography here. A couple reviews and books that I wanted to mention. There was an annual review of entomology published last year. By the way, all of these are going to be in the bibliography, so you don't have to write them down. There's a review in 2007 on the biology of bed bugs by Reinhardt, and then also last year was the Bed Bug Handbook was published, and I did see this in the exhibit hall. There's a couple copies of this remaining down there, by Larry Pinto, Rick Cooper, and Sandy Kraft. So it's a nice practitioner's guide to bed bug management. It talks about inspection and various insecticide use and IPM practices for bed bugs. Got some really nice color plates up in the front of the book, so I would recommend that as well. Anytime I see papers on chemical ecology of any pest group, it gets me excited about the potential, of course, for at some point in time down the line, the development of monitoring tools. And so in 2007 and 2008, Siljander published a series of papers on identification. The one back in 08 was identification of airborne aggregation pheromone of the common bed bug. And what they did was they essentially took a glass chamber, they let bed bugs soil a harborage, and they pulled air across that, clean air across that harborage, trapped it on a core pack, eluted with several different solvents, and then bioassayed that and found indeed that there was a blend of about 10 compounds, a pretty complicated blend of 10 compounds that elicited aggregation in bed bugs. So somebody in the audience might know whether this is headed anywhere in terms of monitoring tools. I don't know. But there was another paper published in 07 talking about evidence for male and juvenile-specific contact pheromones. So hopefully that will lead, at some point, will lead somewhere. The two papers that kept me up at night were a paper on the levels of resistance that we're seeing in field populations of bed bugs, and then another paper on the response of resistant bed bugs to pyrethroid spread. So let's talk about this one first. It's published in 2007 the Journal of Medical Entomology, and Alvaro Romero and Mike Potter and Mike and Dan Potter and Ken Haynes were looking at levels of resistance in bed bugs, and they randomly chose about 10 or 12 different colonies of bed bugs from around the country, and they're showing resistance ratios in these randomly selected strains of over 12,000. So this is to deltamethrin. These are resistance ratios to deltamethrin. They did find a semi-susceptible strain in California. So the red dots here are the where they had discovered resistant strains. This is a strain out in California. Most of them were up here in Ohio and in Michigan, Virginia, and then up in the Northeast and down in Florida. These resistant strains showed 0% mortality at 10 times the labeled rate of this insecticide. Okay, that compared, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the, Deanie Miller had also done a little bit on, she's also generating some independent data on her own, looking at resistance ratios and developing some toxicity data on various pyrethroid insecticides in some of her local strains as well. So she's showing that in susceptible strains, she's looking at LT50 values that are on the order of less than an hour, and compared to field strains, we're talking about 19 days, 3 days, 12 hours. Okay, so that combined, let me go back a little bit, that combined with the other paper that is in press, that Alvaro has in press right now, suggests that bed bugs respond to deltamethrin and other pyrethroid deposits by dispersing, unless that harborage happens to be, unless there happens to be a soiled harborage, so that can be overcome. But the concern in these two papers taken together is that the application of pyrethroid insecticides to clean surfaces will wind up dispersing incredibly resistant populations of bedbugs. And so we see a number of folks are out working on alternative methods for bed bug control at this point, such as heat treatments and things of that sort. Okay, let's talk a little bit about termites. Again, we use these search terms up here. We've included cryptotermes and sizotermes and calotermes for the drywood termite. Wasn't a lot on drywood termites published since January of 2007. But it did add 266 references to the bibliography since January of 2007. That's maybe half of the number of hits that we had. So the one paper I did want to talk about here was a paper that it's on RNA interference, and Nina was talking about this by Joe Wheeler, Faithful, and Mike Scharf. RNA interference in the termite reticulotermes flavipes through ingestion of double-stranded RNA. So again, this is a series. This is a culmination of a series of papers that Mike had had published leading up to this paper. And his group had identified a number of cellulase enzymes in termites. They identified the, several genes for these. They identified a developmental protein that's used in cast regulation in the termite called hexamerin. And so what? This area, this whole area of functional genomics is one where if you can silence a gene and you can look at the phenotype of the creature, then you can confirm or deny the function of that gene. So if you have a particular gene that you know or suspect would be critical to the survival of that creature, then if you silence it, you might be able to harm the creature. And so that's what Mike did. They went in and they looked at they silenced two genes, one coding for cellulase and another coding for this hexamerin protein, this developmental protein. Early on, they injected the material, but later on what they did was they actually took the double-stranded RNA that they made, put it on a piece of filter paper, let the termites eat it, and it killed them. And so this is, I think, a very exciting area, you know, that I think we've hopefully, this area will continue to develop, and in the future we may see a whole new class of insecticides coming from this, which would be very, very, very exciting. I did want to comment, just one brief comment, about the current status of Coptotermes formosanus in the southeastern U.S., Louisiana, of course, and Texas and Alabama and Florida are The story just continues to evolve, and I think what we're doing is essentially detecting existing populations of termites, but this is the 10th anniversary of the Formosan Subterranean Termite Project in New Orleans, so I wanted to give that a comment there. In 1998, there was a 15-block area that was where the Formosan Subterranean Termite Group started working, and in that time, in that 10-year time period, this is a number of alates trapped on sticky cards in that 15-block area. You can see kind of a general decline in the number of alates trapped in that area. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the ants. Here's the keywords that we searched here for ants. Again, a lot of the papers that were on Chromatogaster seed distribution in the Amazon rainforest, I did not include those kind of papers in the bibliography. Very interesting work, but so it added 124 references to the bibliography. Jules Silverman this year and Brightwell published a paper on the Argentine ant challenges in managing an invasive unicolonial pest. So if you want to get into the Argentine ant literature, get caught up to speed. That's a very good paper on management of Argentine ants in the future and where we might be going in the management of Argentine ants. In light of the current talk about invasive species, Jason Myers and Roger Gold published a paper this year on we've all heard of this Paratrachina species, this crazy ant that has shown up in Houston, Texas. They published a paper in Sociobiology recently where this critter came into the port of Houston back in 2002 and has since spread to 5 counties. The flavor of the paper essentially says they're not ready to claim this is an undescribed species. So if you look at this term, if you look at this ant, that's the Texas Paratrachina pubens. That's the same critter, presumably from Coral Gables, Florida. This is pubens from Paraguay and the Galapagos Islands. So this is a very complicated problem, it seems, and they're working with James Traeger and trying to determine once and for all whether this truly is an undescribed species or whether this is a second introduction of a crazy ant, a similar crazy ant that's in the Jacksonville, Florida area. Cho and Rust in 2008 published a paper on horizontal transfer of insecticides in laboratory colonies of the Argentine ant. For multiple years now, folks that work in social insects, both termites and ants, have been looking at transfer of insecticides, various insecticides among social insects because of their sociality. So essentially what they did here was they took 7 insecticides, each formulated at 10, 20, or 40 parts per million, and only fipronil at 20 and 40 parts per million resulted in transfer, resulting in ant mortality greater than control mortality. So they had 19 treatments. There were 19 treatments in this, and it was a fairly straightforward study. They took 10 ants were removed out of a small colony of about 250 to 260 ants, and they removed those ants, exposed them to one of those 19 treatments for 1 minute, and then put those ants back into the arena, and then essentially looked at mortality daily for the next 7 days. And the only two treatments that resulted in any significant mortality above the control were the 20 and 40 part per million fipronil treatments. So all the other treatments, all the other 17 insecticides at various combinations of concentrations didn't really do any better than the control. There have been 2 key books published in the past 2 years. The first one by John Claus, Laurel Hansen, Reiner Pospischil, and Mike Rust, Urban Ants of North America and Europe, Identification, Biology, and Management. This is at the Cornell University Press table downstairs. I'd recommend you pick that up, take a look at that. This book is nice in that at the end of the first chapter you have a key to the subfamilies. And so the rest of the book is every chapter is a subfamily that you have keyed out in the first chapter, and then within that that chapter is a key to the genera. And then you have various aspects on biology and control within those chapters. Second to the last chapter is a chapter on medical aspects of stings and bites. And then the very last chapter is a 25-page chapter on ant management. So that's what it looks like. You've all seen that. There are a couple really nice color plates on the up front in this book. And then the other book is something that was published last year on the Ants of North America. It's a guide to the genera. So the first 50 pages of this book is it's a key to the genera of ants. And then you go back throughout the book after that 50 pages, the genera are in alphabetical order. And so you go back and you can read a little bit about them. And there are, every page has a color plates on the ants, and tells a little bit about the description and their distribution. So anybody who's working in ants or looks to be working in ants in future years, I would recommend that you get both of these. They're very good keys. Rick Vetter, anybody who works in extension deals with spiders. So I would recommend anybody with a partial extension appointment or who works in the pest control industry, perhaps. Rick published two reviews this year. One is on medical aspects of spider bites. Certainly a very well-needed, review, as published in the Annual Review of Entomology in 2008. And he also published a review in the Journal of Arachnology on spiders of the genus Loxosceles, a review of biological, medical, and psychological aspects regarding envenomations. Mike Merchant last year published a really nice little pamphlet on IPM in schools. With some of his colleagues. And then last but certainly not least is the Public Health Significance of Urban Pests, the World Health Organization book that many of you were in this room were part of, were authors on various chapters of that. So I haven't seen this downstairs. If it is, I haven't found it. But the chapters here are in the 8 to 10, maybe 15 pages with references, and all the key pest groups on from ticks to mites to bed bugs and rats and cockroaches and anything of medical and medical importance would be included in this book. There was Byron Reed sent me a copy of a what appeared to be a scaled down version of this that was published for folks in Europe alone, so it appeared to be a European version of this. So that's all I had, and if I'll certainly entertain any questions. Most of the authors of all of these papers are walking around the hallway, so if I can't answer the details, I'm sure that you can find them. So thank you very much.